Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Trupanion Medical Insurance for the life of your pet is a proud sponsor of Pure Dog Talk. Trupanion invites you to sign up for their breeder support program. This program allows breeders to provide their buyers with special offers to help protect the puppy in the event of any unexpected accidents or illnesses as they transition to their new home. By clicking the link on my partner page, you can join the program today. Additionally, Trupanion will provide you with informational materials for your puppy kits, and they'll offer one-on-one support, all at no cost to you. Sign up at the partner page today and mention Pure Dog Talk sent you. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I am your host, Laura Reeves, and we have a really fun guest today. I'm super excited to welcome Dr. Jerry Klein. Dr. Klein is the official chief veterinary officer for the American Kennel Club, which I think is very cool. And I'm super thrilled that you're here to join us. So thank you.
It's my pleasure. And I'm honored to be part of this.
Excellent. Okay. So I ask everybody, give us the 411. How did you get started in purebred dogs? You come from Afghans, if I understand correctly, right?
I am more well known for Afghans, but I started with wire fox terriers, which is why I judge a lot of the terriers. But
okay.
I was a kid growing up in Cleveland, Ohio, with a very non-doggy, non-animal family. But I was that kid. And
right.
I think there's a lot of people that I know in dogs that are always those people. You kind of know from the start that you love animals. And we didn't have any. We're considering having one. And so what I did, and I would read about them all the time in libraries and everything else, try to find a local place or camp to go horseback riding.
Right.
And I would start zoning in on things like that. And after hounding my parents for a dog, and of course, no dog, no dog. And this is in Cleveland, Ohio. And I was not born in the United States. I was born in Tangier, Morocco. So
oh,
we immigrated
wow.
to this country in 1958. So about 10 or 11 years went by of nagging them. And we had a home in the States. And in that era, you know, when you wanted a dog and you were a kid with a Jewish family that didn't have any idea about dogs,
right?
We looked in the newspaper and there was a pet shop. And so I finally convinced them for my, I think it was 11th or 12th birthday, to drive out to the west side, all the way to the west side of Cleveland, to a pet shop to go get a dog. And they had all breed, I think it was called All Breed Pet Shop or something like that. You know, we didn't know about it. And there were two puppies available. And one cage was a beagle and the other cage was a wire fox terrier. And they go, which one do you want? So that was my fork in the road.
Right. Right, exactly.
I picked the wire fox terrier.
Awesome.
And his name was Skippy. And he had papers because at that time, even my mom knew that if a dog had papers, that it was something, in Spanish it's called perros de raza, of race.
Right.
A purebred.
Right.
And a certain kind of quality. You know, so even then we knew that a dog with papers was different than just a dog off the street. And so he had papers and he had AKC papers. And so that was my introduction to the world of purebred dogs. And of course, with that, they give you this little thing to get. But he was riddled with problems and he had coccidia, giardia. And because he went to the vet so often, I think I became enamored with going with him to the vet. And the local vet let me kind of hang in on certain things. And he was actually a pretty good vet for in that era.
Right.
But I became kind of really enthralled with that aspect of it. And that kind of put the bug in me. But even in that time, I kept reading about dogs. And you're able to order a pedigree at that time. And they had a pedigree service if you had a purebred dog. You can order the 3-generation, the 5-generation, or the 7-generation pedigree. And I had my parents do the 7-generation pedigree. And what was unique about that is all the dogs were listed, and the non-champion dogs were all in black, and the champion dogs were in red.
Right.
Well, about the 6th generation or 7th generation, there was a couple of red ones. And one dog, in the very, very end, his name was Champion, Gallant Fox of Wild Oats.
Oh, wow.
And I remember that I went to the library, and his picture was in one of those books.
Right.
So in its own little way, my little Skippy, who was not of show quality, was related to that dog, but
right.
I felt in touch with that, you know, and it was like, well, pretty hot stuff. And that was my start in dogs, you know. And back in the days, they used to have in the Cleveland, there was two newspapers, the Plain Dealer and the Cleveland Press. And there was newspapers in some of the major cities used to have writers for dog events.
Right.
I think New York Times had Walter Fletcher.
Mm-hmm.
But in Cleveland, we were very lucky to have Maxwell Riddle.
Oh, he was a genius.
Well, Max Riddle wrote a column, and because of him, I became aware that there was a dog show called the Chagrin Valley Kennel Club, which had at that time over 3,000 dogs. It was held at the Polo Field, and it wasn't too far from where we lived. So I was able to get my family to go there on a Sunday and go to a dog show, and I was enthralled. And I went by the Afghan ring, and even then, they had, it must have been, I think, a specialty in conjunction with
right.
it. And I remember dog class after class of these dogs, and I couldn't get away from that. I just kind of knew it. But I got to see all the dogs, but I was like, that was really puts a bug in me about Afghan hounds. And I love my fox terrier, don't get me wrong, but I knew Afghan, there's some kind of connection. You know, mm-hmm. I think it was a combination. They were exotic and glamorous. And I kind of thought I was born in Morocco and I had that exoticism. I'm trying to like give myself a little more, you know, mystique, whatever the case may be. But whatever it was, there was a connection. But I kind of vowed that, you know, the next year I'm going to show my dog there. Well, to show a wire fox terrier and to strip hair and you don't know how to do it, it's pretty
right.
hard to do.
Right.
But, yeah, I was able to find a local groomer that had Airedales at one time. He was kind enough. You bring your dog in to me 12 weeks before a show, and then 8 weeks before a show, and then 6 weeks before, and I'll keep trimming. So that's how I did it.
Okay.
My dad was a doctor, and I was too young to drive, and he worked on Saturdays. So I entered the next year the Chagrin Valley Dog Show, and I entered him in novice class.
Sure.
I was a novice, and he was a novice, and the stipulation is you can show a dog in novice, you can get 3 first places in novice.
Right.
Well, guess what? I showed him 3 years in a row in novice, and I won 3 first place ribbons. And I framed that ribbon, and, you know, I was
oh
the whole
my
bit,
God.
You know.
I
was
it.
That guy. But because my dad was a doctor, I could only show then after that on Sundays, and only when he was in hair. So
right.
by this time, my dog was like 4 or 5, and I showed him like 3 or 4 times a year, and I got 4 points on him, and he wasn't a good dog. You know, he was cow hock. But I did learn a lot from that dog. I learned that you had to have a decent dog to win. I didn't
right.
get discouraged and stop. But I also learned more about people. I'll never forget the second show I went to. Oh, no, it was maybe the 4th show. It was pouring rain, and my poor dad came with me wearing rain gear. And we were waiting to go in, and there was a breed before. There was a Scotty, and the woman came out. It was pouring rain, and my dad was sitting in this chair that he brought. And she had a ribbon, and my dad thought she dropped her ribbon because it was like a red ribbon or
uh-huh,
something else.
Uh-huh.
And he goes, "Ma'am, I think you dropped this." And she goes, or whatever it was. It wasn't what she wanted. She threw it in the garbage can.
Oh.
And my dad looked at me, and he was just appalled by her behavior. So I learned from my dad manners, but also sportsmanship from that person. So I learned, you know, those kind of things you get when you're like 12, 13 years of age. And I showed in junior showmanship, but you learned how not to be, you know.
Right.
And I think that was just as important.
How not to be.
Yeah, how not to be. And I kind of learned that during my years. And so that was kind of interesting.
Awesome. So fast forward.
Fast forward, I went to vet school, and at that point, I had a couple of decent wire fox that I finished, and I also had bred some litters, and then graduated from Ohio State Vet School, and I became kind of like partner with a gentleman called Ken Tibby, and we had Sebring Afghan hounds, and I started judging in 1985, and then I had friends and mentors in Afghans. I worked emergency medicine for 36 years, so that means nights, holidays, and weekends, and that
yeah.
certainly curtailed my judging. That's why it went and stopped and starts, because there's nothing less fun than judging a wonderful show on Sunday, having to catch a flight and be back at work in a war zone at 10 o'clock in the evening.
Yeah.
So it became too much. So I stopped judging for a while, or very limitedly. But emergency medicine taught me an awful lot about animals, veterinarians, and people as well. A lot of these things you learn about people as well as the animals. But then I bred dogs, I judged an exhibitor, and I was a veterinarian. I became kind of and at the end of my line, I've been doing emergency because the body and mind couldn't take 12-hour shifts much longer.
Yeah, right.
The American Kennel Club reached out for a position called the chief veterinary officer. You know, they had never had one before, which is kind of unique and unusual, but they were looking for someone that would be able to basically handle any immediate concerns. And I looked at it as kind of a triangle. You know, I represented the American Kennel Club and its members and fanciers, you know, my people.
Right.
But also my people being also veterinarians in the veterinary world and veterinary students, because I felt they were kind of ignorant, especially in the last 20 years of purebred dogs.
Mm.
And also the general public. informing them, because certainly to our mind, there was a stigma against purebred dogs and purebred dog breeders and fanciers by the animal rights activists and the adopt, don't shop attitude.
Right.
So, you know, the fact that I kind of wore those many hats of exhibitor, owner, breeder, judge, veterinarian, I was obviously a likely suspect candidate. And I remember going for the interview, and it was in the old AKC library, the Walter Goodman Library, which is hallowed grounds.
Yes.
And it was two chairs, and it was like I was going for a 60-minute interview, and Alan Calder sat across from me with his lights shining on me, and it was mic'd. And thankfully, I had done some kind of PR TV work here in Chicago for other things. So I wasn't very freaked out. And Alan Calder came, he goes, I'm going, hi, how are you? And I said, fine. He goes, I'm going to ask you a series of questions, and by the end, you're going to hate me. Said, okay, great. And basically, what he would try to do, basically, is ask me questions that, to the mundane, to the more controversial questions, mm-hmm. to see how I'd present myself and the AKC to the public if that were the case. And I think I did okay, obviously. So the position was granted to me, and it's been a wonderful position. And I remember I had to judge at the dog show shortly after I got the position. And the reception I got, it was in California, was incredible. Everyone thought, I think their fellow breeders and exhibitors in my group from that aspect felt for a long time that they hadn't been heard or needed to be represented in a different manner. We have a stigma, you know, and I think mm-hmm. whether we know it or don't, we have developed a stigma. And I've always led my life, and I'm very lucky to, I don't know how I got here, but there's a lot of different things happen. But the life that I have led, especially through purebred dogs, it's one of pride, not of shame.
Right.
I've never done anything that I'm not proud of personally and professionally. And I feel the people I've been associated with and associate with are lifetime friends, which the social aspect, and I feel that they have enriched my life compared to my contemporaries who are here in Chicago, my friends who are not involved in dogs.
Right.
But I felt that my reception there was, thank you so much for being there. We really want you to, you know, I felt really welcomed. And I've always felt welcomed in this dog world, being a gay man, being a veterinarian. There's nothing, I think that's been so inclusive. And I really feel proud to represent that aspect of it. So I look at myself as kind of like a mediator from all aspects of the sport, to be able to talk to veterinarians and the general public and fellow AKC purebred dog fanciers, breeders, et cetera, and trying to represent them. Because I think that in many ways, the veterinary world has kind of turned their backs on us. You know, in certain vet schools mm-hmm. don't teach cesarean, don't teach small animal pterygiology or minimalize it. And so this is my fourth year. I speak to vet schools, and I've been very lucky to be on board and meet some incredible people in AKC, be involved with the Canine Health Foundation,
right.
the Review Committee for Scientific Studies with Diane Brown, who's genius.
I love Diane. Love her.
Yeah, an amazing person. And then also Maribeth O'Neill.
Yep.
And with the Vet Outreach Program, going to conventions, speaking at the AVMA convention, and also reviewing scholarships from vet students
mm-hmm.
to award scholarships through the Vet Outreach Program. And Maribeth is another person who not only is a great friend, but I respect her so much in
yes.
her knowledge of everything that goes on and how fair-minded and level-headed she can be. And she's a great person to have dinner with.
Yeah, Maribeth is one of my gods. You know what I'm saying? Like, she just really, definitely the keeper of the secrets.
Yeah, and she doesn't want to keep it a secret. She's more than happy to, like,
right.
be realistic. And she
right.
has her head in. She's one of those unique people that knows the tradition of it, but knows where it's also
right.
going in the future. And I think that's the key aspect of where AKC is right now. There's part of it that's steeped in tradition, which is wonderful, because purebred dogs, a lot of it is tradition. But then we have to realize that we have to retain certain aspects of it, to bring it into the millennium, and then to update it. And then there's always going to be new people coming in. And then we have to be aware of that and trying to be open and trying to bring people into our fray, so to speak.
Right. And I think you make a really great point about that kind of point of the fulcrum, right, between tradition and inviting in new people. And I think that's a constant struggle for the organization, for our fancy in general.
I think so. I think that it's an interesting group of people that we have. With social media, I've learned about people that I thought I knew,
yeah.
for better or for worse.
Right.
And I know that some are much more conservative than I suspected, or more liberal than I suspected, or vice versa, in their general lives. And I think the manifestation in the dog world, it's kind of parallel to that as well.
Right.
And some people like the old, good old days, but sometimes the good old days weren't good for everyone and every animal either.
Right.
I think what people could get away with in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, you could never get away with right now.
Right.
And I think we have to realize that, and then think that the best times that's not behind us, but hopefully in front of us. And I think we have to look at this, our sport, our fantasy, and what we have to offer with a positive attitude and not with this negative, oh, those days gone by. Because those days gone by, when you really speculate it, we're not so wonderfully won.
Hang tight, guys. Got a little bit of information for you. We'll be right back to the podcast in a minute. Heads up, crew. Join our patrons today. Get immediate access to the support of a closed Facebook chat group, special patrons-only episodes, free mentoring sessions, and more. Just like the NPR of dogdom, Pure Dog Talk brings you the news, the knowledge, and the insight to succeed with your purebred dog. In exchange, our Pure Dog patrons share the love with monthly or annual gifts, and that helps defray the cost of overhead and sort of keeping the MP3s rolling, you know? Hit me up, laura@puredogtalk.com, and I'll hook you up with the details. I want to just kind of touch back to one of the things that you said earlier, because it very much resonated for me, and I think it's an important piece to pick up on, and that is the dog fancy is so much a place for everyone, whether it is a person of color, whether it is a person, you know, like, it's a great place for everyone. And I just think that that is so important to focus on. Everybody's welcome here.
Yeah, I don't think we focus on it enough. I think what we're judged on is the quality of what we bring to the ring.
Exactly.
Or what we bring to the conversation. I think that in very few sports can I ever know where you can be seated with person to your left, someone that is old money, main line.
Right.
You know, and then to your right, someone that may have barely anything to them, but they breed quality dogs. And they will be respected, and you can have a conversation on equal ground.
Yes.
And enjoy a laugh and a dinner and realize that you have commonality there. And I think that, as you mentioned, when I went to a dog show, I knew I was gay even before I came out, but I was like 11, 12, and I went to a dog show down. I saw gay people there, and I thought, this is my way out.
So right.
Whether you choose it, it's like the circus. It's like the circus. It was a way for me to express myself. So my love of animals and that aspect of it, but the dog show community, I felt commonality there.
Yes.
And one thing I do have to mention, and during this many years of being involved in this, and I'm very lucky to be able to have, and one thing that I want to say, how much appreciative of every aspect I have, is how many friends that we've lost many years ago to AIDS, and really prominent people in the world of dogs and hounds especially, and all breeds as well. People that find Carlos DeBango and Joe Langford, and the list goes on and on and on. I don't want to name anyone and cite anyone like that, but the fact that they were there, and that was a big part of it. And so we went through that, and that kind of put a dent in us. But I think we were resilient, and we still kind of came back. And I think we don't give ourselves credit for that as well.
Right.
A lot to be said for that, you know?
Yeah, exactly. To me, it's just such a huge piece of what I love about the sport. And it's what you say, that equal footing, right? And you aren't judged by your skin color or your sexual requirement. None of it. None of it except the quality of your dog. And I just think that that is so important.
I think that, to me, what keeps me going, and the friendships and the social that has kept me in it as being a lifer, as a friend of mine, Paul Lepiani.
Right. We are lifers. Hi, Paul.
I'm going to give him props, too, by the way.
Yes.
Because, Paul is, I think, one of the most influential people. We're very insular. Before social media, we kind of happening in our country, mostly through. But when he brought out the African Hound Review, and there were interviews of breeders in Germany and Sweden and Australia, we saw there were other people doing good things as well. And we were able, I think I've made the world a better place, and better, certainly better dogs, realizing you could build a better mousetrap if you kept your eyes open. And when I started judging abroad in different countries, I learned more about my breed. And I think judging, you learn about a breed as you go. I think one of the problems with judging is everyone feels the facade of having to know everything as if you do. And I think that's never true. I think you're always learning. You know, in fact, I think it was Annie Clark that once said, you shouldn't apply to judge another breed until you judge what you judge, at least at a specialty show level. And I kind of understand. I kind of took that to heart. When I was a kid, I wanted to be an all-breed judge. And I've learned as I got older, I really didn't want to be. I just wanted to be really good and into whatever I was judging at the moment. And I think I've been lucky enough at this point in my life where I don't have to judge much. I just don't want to judge what I want to judge. And then hopefully it shows to the exhibitors, and I try to be fair and square. But I mean, the fact that you can just kind of really be into the moment and get into something, it's such a cool thing.
Yeah, and that is definitely, I've just recently gotten my first provisional breeds, and it's the same thing. I mean, these are the breeds I want to judge, right? Like, I don't want to get the whole sporting group just to get the whole sporting group. I want to judge these dogs that I like and these breeds that I like and really focus on that. and it's kind of fun.
Well, that's the kick. You know, that's the fun part. There's so many different fun parts of judging, you know.
Right.
Not knowing who you're judging and then going back later and looking in the cat, oh yeah, winner's dog and winner's bitch were half brother, sister,
right,
or something. Or
right.
There's a commonality here. You know, even in a breed that may not be yours. And one thing, I never make an assumption. If I just did a big Cairn Terrier specialty the day after the regional or something, and you find commonalities. And, you know, certainly there's people that I'm judging their dogs that are better at Cairn Terriers. They've lived their whole lives than I have. But you do your best. You know, you do study and you take every assignment to heart. And I think that judges, we have to give ourselves props as well. Again, there's that stigma, and I think we have to kind of learn to be proud of who and what we do.
Okay, I'm going to take us on a segue here because I think this is kind of an interesting topic as well. You, as the manager of a very busy emergency medicine center, right? You've seen everything there is to see.
Well, I retired from that aspect a year and a half ago when the American Kennel Club started out as a part-time, and
right,
certainly in 4 years, it takes a larger consulting within a larger portion of my time. So I stopped doing emergency work. It'll be 2 years this November. For many years, I was the department head of the emergency at the largest emergency clinic in Chicago, and certainly one of the busiest ones in the country.
Well, and that's the experience I want to draw on, because I see on social media or I hear from listeners or what have you, when you're working with an emergency clinic, right? You're almost always working with doctors that you don't know and don't know your dogs, and everybody's in high drama. And so, you know, it's terrible. It's scary. The dog is sick. The dog is dying, whatever it is. And so I'm wondering if you can provide some suggestions, some input to the listeners. What are really useful things that an owner can do when working with the staff at an emergency center in that sort of a situation? How is the best way to get the best result from that?
Well, I think a couple of things. First of all, certainly a lot of veterinarians have a hard time working with quote breeders. They feel that they're difficult to work with. You sometimes challenge their opinion, and sometimes right. Anyway, so there's a guard on both sides of it.
Right.
From the clients coming in to the veterinarians treating, and not all veterinarians are breeder friendly. So first of all, if you are one, you should try to find a veterinarian that is mano a mano in your goal. And I will say, I may recently put out a policy about a year and a half ago, which I think was part of trying to, and having veterinarians learn about the genetics of dogs and everything else. That being said, it's stressful on both sides of it. No, trust me, when I first got the job, I thought, someone who doesn't know me from a hole in the ground, I'm going to get charged this amount of money. And how are they going to take that from me? And then there's stress. It can be on both sides of the table. That being said, you listen and question. And then if you feel that something is inappropriate or not right, ask why. But also realize that when you go into an emergency room in a hospital, the same kind of questions you would ask to an ER doctor there as well. The one thing I have to mention, in the 30-some years of veterinary medicine, vet med has changed a lot. I mean, what's capable of doing MRI, CT scans, ultrasounds is great. That being said, it's also become a lot more expensive.
Right.
There's no question it's become more expensive. And one of the things I advocate now on the general owner is pet insurance.
Right.
You know, I mean, because if we're going to want to have that done, and a weekend at my emergency clinic, if you had a dog that either needed a transfusion or surgery, certainly $3,000 to $4,000, or a dog that has chronic illness. Now, granted, breeders have a kennel, it might be a little less likely to be able to do that. But unfortunately, if you're going to want Gold Star treatment, you're going to have to pay those kind of prices. The insurance is there for that reason, because vet med is now paralleling the quality of medicine to human medicine. So things can be done. And a lot of research is being done. But if breeders still have their heads in the 1950s and 1960s, but we're doing in the year 2019, 2020, as far as that type of medicine, you can't have it both ways. It has to be difficult on that. First, you should talk to your veterinarian if you have a bitch that needs like a C-section or something like that.
Right.
Many emergency vets don't know how to do sections without spaying or have policies against it. And you should find that out beforehand. I mean, I guess the whole point of emergency is there's two kinds of emergency. There's the emergency you never plan, which is most of them. And sometimes you can get a hold of your vet, sometimes you can't. And then the ones you kind of can plan. If you have a bitch that you think may have to have a section, it's not going to be a surprise a couple of months, you know, that you have you should do your homework and find out, have a discussion with that and know your facility, and then talk to your veterinarian about basics to be expected. The stress level is high, granted, but hopefully you understand when a medical problem is a problem, when a medical problem is an emergency. And
right,
I think that is the difference. If you're on the road and you can't get to your veterinarian and the stress of that, you're going to have to go to an emergency service or a local veterinarian. But I'll tell you one thing. I think a good veterinarian listens to a good breeder. and makes a breeder better, and vice versa. A good breeder will make a veterinarian better as well. But emergency vets sometimes are at a little different point in their career, and the stress level is different. And emergency medicine has changed even during my tenure there.
Mm-hmm.
It went from being more of a familial kind of co-op of various hospitals in the area to now being owned by a corporation with different policy.
Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately, that aspect is changing. And we have to realize that veterinary medicine is changing to a more of a corporate world. And that is unfortunate for many of the breeders in us, and it's an unfortunate reality of it.
Right. Right. I think that definitely the changes that I've seen, you know, in my time from when I was a kid with my family, and our veterinarian would come out to the house to help with AIs on the Clumber Spaniels, you know, I mean, to today, I'm still fortunate enough to have that type of veterinarian, but I know a lot of people that aren't.
Well, I think that's exactly what the case, and you have to search them out. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. not everyone has access to that kind of a veterinarian, which
right.
used to be more about the family vet, the farm
right.
vet. So it's like a family doctor. I mean,
mm-hmm.
doctors used to do house calls. I mean,
right.
that's not even common anymore. So it's not just that med, it's life.
Yeah.
It's just changing. And either we have to realize that aspect of it, you know, we're not being singled out as being that. It's our society is changing in that way.
Right. Right. Absolutely. Well, Dr. Klein, I appreciate your time so much. I know I have kept you long, and I really, really appreciate you coming and talking to us. I look forward to, you were telling me before we got on air that you just came back from New York and you're going out on a regular basis from Chicago to New York to do work with AKC-TV. So tell us a little bit about that and where exhibitors or fanciers can find some of this information.
Well, AKC-TV has, obviously they film quite a few segments, and one of the segments is called Ask the Experts. It's an every other week kind of thing where they pick a topic from the mundane animal husbandry thing to athletics to canine athletes and their feed or gut microbiome. So people hopefully will learn, people that are first-time dog owners and seasoned dog owners as well. So hopefully we try to inform people and keep people entertained as well.
Excellent. People can find that at the AKC-TV app, right?
Yes, exactly.
Excellent.
And write columns that are syndicated to go to various magazines, whether it's O or Martha Stewart or general publications. So we're trying to keep AKC and word out to the general public.
Right.
And I think that's important for all of us to do our job in promoting and reaching out to the general public. Only in that way can we promote purebred dogs. If we stay in our own inclusive circles, we're never going to get the word out, and people are not going to learn about us and who and what we are.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with you on that. All right. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Klein. I really appreciate your time, and I know you've got a hectic schedule, so I am grateful for you granting me some of it. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks.
As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to laura@puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here. Take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our dog show superintendents are the hardworking people who make the dog show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the super's desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk.